Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting under House Rule 10.01, which allows us to meet remotely. We will start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excuse. Representative Hur. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. Representative Scott, I want to move the minutes. Is this regarding the minutes? All right. Nope. All right. Let's see. Representative Zhang, do I have a motion to move the minutes of March 5th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved from March 5th, 2021. We have a really full agenda, but Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge, as this is the beginning of deadline week, I just want to acknowledge our staff, both partisan and nonpartisan, and how hard they work in general, but especially these deadline weeks. And so I just wanted to say a thank you to them. Probably spent the better part of a very nice weekend behind their computer screen working on our behalf. So I just wanted to thank them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Scott. I know that my job would be much, much harder with all of them. And I know the pressure is really on with the amendment deadlines in all kinds of different places. So good reminder. Quickly, we have to, we got a motion to reconsider members. So we noticed House File 835. This is a bill from last week. We had a full bill presentation. It was one of the housing bills that Representative Herr had. After we sent it to the General Register, we found out that there may actually be a fiscal cost. And so since we were premature in sending it to the General Register, I am going to move to reconsider that motion and then lay the bill over until we have that fiscal note so that we know that we're moving it to the right place. So I will move to reconsider the March 2nd, 2021 motion to recommend that House File 835 as amended be placed on the General Register. Is there any discussion to this motion? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. All right. The motion prevails and House File 835 is now back in front of us. And now I will lay over House File 835 as amended for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill and further consideration. So now we got that taken care of, we can move on to our very full agenda today. The first bill on our agenda is House File 1237. It is a Representative Hansen bill regarding the MPCA, the Pollution Control Agency, for those of you not an Environment Committee, agency bill. And we will be focusing our discussion today to the sections 10, 11, and 12 regarding civil law, and then Section 13, Subdivision 4, which has some data implications. Representative Hansen, I will move your bill that House File 1237 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. We have the bill in front of us, and now I understand that we have an author's amendment, the A3 amendment. Representative Hansen, could you briefly summarize what the A3 amendment does?
Madam Chair, I believe the Pollution Control Agency can update on that particular amendment.
All right. Whoever from MPCA wants to tell us what that amendment does, please introduce yourself and go. Oh, Ms. Gauthier, please introduce yourself and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm an Assistant Commissioner for Legislative and Congressional Relations at the MPCA. For those members not on the Environment Committee, the MPCA is the state level delegated agency from the US EPA. Thank you for this opportunity. I can talk about the items in the A3 amendment. They fall in two categories. They are both, all of the language is portions of policy items from the governor's budget recommendations. So the first portions are language in the beginning and towards the end of the amendment that is intended to clarify our enforcement statutes and provide a very clear deterrent. This language comes after two major enforcement cases we've had in the past few years. So it puts five enforcement changes into Chapter 115, which is the Water Pollution Control Act, and Chapter 116, the MPCA's enabling chapter. And then it also, the second part of this bill is in the middle, and this is pertains to the Landfill Responsibility Act, which is a governor's budget recommendation designed to reduce the amount of waste going into landfills. And as part of this, the agency would do what are called waste composition studies at landfills on a rotating basis. So this language in the A3 allows the agency access on public or private property to perform a waste composition study accurately and safely. And it also requires the agency to make data from waste composition studies publicly available only in summary form. With that, Madam Chair, those are the major changes.
Okay. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and your bill, as amended, is now before us. Representative Hansen, please tell us about your bill. If there's anything else to be said.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a MPCA policy bill that these provisions have been worked on for some time, and we're trying again. They help solve some long-running problems. I think that Ms. Gauthier described quite well with the amendment, and I think that provides a clarity and the purpose on what's happening here. And we have both the Deputy Commissioner, Ms. Gauthier, around if there are additional questions. But appreciate your consideration.
All right, Ms. Gauthier, you're the only testifier I have on the list. Is there anything additional that you would like to share with us in addition to what how you described the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, if I could just speak briefly to the underlying bill. There are some sections that you highlighted. Sections 10 and 11 relate to the Closed Landfills Program. This is a program the legislature created in the 1990s when we started to require landfills to be lined. So the state is responsible for 110 closed landfills in this program, responsible in perpetuity. In 2017, the legislature created a special category of these landfills called qualified priority facilities. Right now, there is only one landfill in that category, and it is a landfill in the South Metro. Sections 10 and 11 of the bill are changes to the priority qualified facility statutes that will close loopholes that leave taxpayer dollars vulnerable when there are cleanups of these facility sites. Section 12, moving on, pertains to a different group of landfills, older landfills. There are about 150 of these around the state. The problem is people don't know where they're located and are accidentally digging them up. So Section 12 allows us to identify these old landfill sites through legally binding agreements. The language makes the legal tools of the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act available to the agency's solid waste program. We already use these tools in our brownfields program. The legally binding agreements would have to be signed by all parties, and it would ensure that future property owners are aware of these sites. Finally, Section 13 gives authority to the MPCA to obtain information on contaminants from potential contamination sources. Having this data will help us identify sources of contamination much quicker, gain efficiencies in addressing contaminated sites, and therefore reducing human exposure to the contamination and also preventing water, land, and air pollution. So, Madam Chair, it gives the agency the ability to seek and obtain information on the use of a contaminant, whether we are in a contaminated site situation or whether we are working on pollution prevention. This would be especially helpful in our work to address PFAS contamination, which is a huge issue in the Metro, East Metro, but other places too. And Madam Chair, we have met with stakeholders who have concerns with Chapter 13, and we are working with them to find language that meets everyone's satisfaction. That concludes my testimony, Madam Chair. As Representative Hansen said, we have agency experts with us to answer questions.
Okay, I do want to get, we have one other testifier, and I want to give that testifier time to speak. I will just remind you that we are just limited to the provisions of the bill that are in the jurisdiction of this committee. And with that, Mr. Quillis, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good evening, committee members. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And Madam Chair, I know the drill. Section 13, Subdivision 4 is where my concern is, and that data. We get to the point of that data, Madam Chair, is where the commissioner simply detects a contaminant, not a violation, still below health risk limits, there's no de minimis, or has reason to believe, the commissioner then may enter a private facility and with written requests ask for all papers, books, tangible items, and anybody within the supply chain of that business. That data all becomes public. Then that business has the onus on them to go to the state agency to say, hey, those sales figures, the processes, methods of production are unique to me and contain my proprietary information, to ask the agency to make that private data. Then, Madam Chair, if you look on page 16.7 of the first engrossment, that private data that makes unique to me and better than my competitors may become public data in any other proceeding, any further action by the agency in terms of permitting or setting a standard, or if another state agency is involved, all my proprietary information that they just came and got is available to my competitors. And that's our concern, Madam Chair, about Section 13. I want to thank Ms. Gauthier for listening to my concerns earlier. We've talked to them, but my concerns still stand right now as the bill is, Madam Chair. And I hate to disagree with my good friend, Ms. Gauthier, and Representative Hansen, but the A3 amendment, Madam Chair, is not just simply clarifying some things for the agency. It gives them unbridled discretion to go in and cease and desist orders on businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm just going to take one highlight, Madam Chair, out of there.
Yep, real quick. I think
real quick.
It was more than
page
forthcoming. 4.19. Mr. Quillis, you got to, Mr. Quillis, you got to let me speak when it's my turn
okay.
to speak.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
I was going to say that Ms. Gauthier was more than forthcoming with what was in the amendment. That was a very thorough explanation of the author's amendment. And you can go ahead now with your testimony.
No, I just wanted to say one point, Madam Chair, is the concern there is where the agency can recover what they call oversight costs. There's no timeline on it. There's no cap. There's no limit. There's no legislative oversight. And the money just goes right to the Pollution Control Agency. So that's my concern on the A3, Madam Chair. I'm glad to see that it's being referred back to Representative Hansen's committee where we can debate it a little bit further.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll just remind members, I know it's sometimes hard via Zoom and we're really in the heat of session, but we really do have to speak through the chair. That's how this process has always worked and how it's going to continue to work in this committee. Representative Scott, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share some of the concerns that Mr. Quillis shared. And I don't know if there are other government agencies or maybe the MPCA has on other occasions the ability just to walk on to someone's private property and confiscate records and that sort of thing without some sort of a warrant or some sort of due process. As I don't know if the bill's author or Ms. Gauthier could kind of clarify that. It just seems like really, it just seems wrong to me to be able for any age government agency to do that without some sort of, due process to do that.
Yep. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Scott, I think Ms. Gauthier could describe the precedent that exists.
I will also note that I've got the MPCA staff attorney on my list as available for questions. So whoever wants from the MPCA wants to answer Representative Scott's question, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your response.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually going to turn it over to my fellow Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka.
Please go ahead, Mr. Kadelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And thank you for the question on that. In regards to the language that's been mentioned here, the specific piece about Subdivision 3, the duty to provide information, the commissioner requests that information, and then lines 16.6 through 16.10 says that if the person does not do that, it fails to comply with the information, then the commissioner can go to the district court. So there is that protection built into the bill. If a person refuses, the agency has to go through with the court process, just like it would anything else. The agency does not get free rein to go on to someone's property to do work in that. They first seek that request for the information and then move forward. So this is very similar to how we operate our Superfund program. You'll see many of those things through 1 through 4 are actually copied directly from our Superfund authority, allowing us to get on the properties to address contaminated sites. So we're mirroring other parts that are already there. Those protections built by the legislature are in this bill, just designed for a new type of situation where we're dealing with contaminants in products. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, as I read the language, it doesn't really say that. I mean, to me, it's like march in there and enter private property and ask questions later. It seems to me that ought to be on the front end, and there ought to be some level of detection here that's going on, instead of just saying they have kind of think that there might be something going on there, and then they march onto this private property and demand documents when there may be nothing there at all. It just seems like everything's kind of flipped on its head there. And the only other issue I had or a question about was just what data sets the commissioner wants to be disclosing under this bill. And I know, Ms. Gauthier, you mentioned that you're working with some people on the data practices piece. Is that part of what you're going to be discussing, Ms. Gauthier? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your question. Yes, we are working with the Chamber and others about that provision. The idea, Madam Chair, is to build into Chapter 13 here a way for there to be some protection of data that meets those criteria laid out in that language. And then the data could be used again, but just specific pieces that may be related to litigation or those other examples in the statute. And again, this does mirror authorities we already have in our Superfund program. This would just be moving them to be allowed in the area of looking at contaminated facilities and also sources of that may come from manufacturing or other facilities upstream.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, between myself and Mr. Quillis, I think those were the issues that I had. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any closing words, Representative Hansen?
We would appreciate your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1237, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairback Griffin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That's 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, with that, the motion prevails, and House File 1237, as amended, is on its way back to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for being on time. With that, we'll move on to the next bill. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1340-1340. It's a Representative Noor bill, the Family First Prevention Act, and we'll remind members that we're going to focus on Article 1, Sections 11 and 12, as well as Article 2, Sections 4 through 6. Welcome to the committee, Chair Noor. I will move your bill. I move that House File 1340 be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Noor, I understand you have an author's amendment that is correcting headings and technical in nature. Would you like me to move your A1 author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. I move the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Noor, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's glad to be back in the Judiciary Committee. This is an agency bill. As amended, this bill contains provisions that will bring the state into compliance with the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act before it becomes effective in October 2021. Members, if you recall, we passed this bill last year. So this is a cleanup. It's just a housekeeping and also clarifying some of the changes that we implemented last year. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have Ms. Sommerfeld from DHS who's going to walk us through some of the provisions.
Sorry, my husband was trying to bring me food, but I can't eat until 6:30. So we will turn it over to Ms. Sommerfeld. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services at DHS. And thank you for hearing the bill tonight, or at least the relevant provisions. And thank you, Representative Noor, for a second year carrying a Family First Prevention Services Act policy bill forward. This is a very large and complicated federal law, and it's taken our staff quite some time to develop statutory language behind it over the last couple of years. So the provisions tonight fall into a couple of categories. The current statute implements Family First, does not provide the courts with enough direction on how to implement the new court review requirements set forward by the FFPSA. So this bill clarifies the QRTP requirements related to juvenile court processes, and the language that we're adding was all developed in consultation with the Children's Justice Initiative. I can certainly walk through each of these provisions individually if you'd like, or I can simply stand for questions if you've had a chance to review the language or the bill index that we've provided, whatever would be your preference, Chair and members of the committee.
All right, thanks, Ms. Sommerfeld. I like to assume that our members have read the bill, and we've got a very full agenda today, but certainly I'm sure members may have questions. Let's see if we've got any other. We don't have any other testifiers. We have quite a few folks from DHS on hand to answer member questions if there are any. Any discussion, members? All right. Well, I will take that one. So thank you, members. Representative Noor, any closing words on your bill as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate your support for this bill. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Chair Knorr. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1340 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excuse. Representative Herr. Representative Herr. Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Bang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Herr. One more
aye.
Time. Aye. Okay, and Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Perfect. There's 16 ayes.
All right, thank you. With that, the motion prevails, and House File 1340 as amended is recommended to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Chair Knorr. Next on the agenda, hopefully Representative Egbaje is here. She's next up on the yes, she is. All right. So the next bill we'll be hearing tonight is House File 1151. I know people are like juggling a lot of stuff tonight, so trying to be patient with everybody. House File 1151 is the African American Family Preservation Act. We'll remind members that we're going to focus on Section 6 relating to civil law, as well as Section 9 relating to data. Representative Egbaje, I will move your bill. I move that House File 1151 be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. I understand you also have an A1 amendment that is technical in nature. Representative Egbaje, would you like me to move your A1 author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move the A1 author's amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All right. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I always have to be quick when you do that amendment stuff. I just wondered if the bill's author could explain what the amendment does. I can't remember. I'm all mixed up. If this is just one of those more technical ones, if it's more substantive, thank you.
Oh, totally understand, Representative Scott. Representative Egbaje.
Yes. So this amendment is very much technical in nature. It cleans up some of the language, makes the name of the Oversight Council consistent throughout the bill, as well as an ordering of some of the sections, making sure that it does go A, B, C, D, and not A, B, B, C, D. So.
That definitely sounds like a technical amendment. Any further discussion to the A1 amendment? All right, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Egbaje, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Tonight, I am presenting House File 1151, which is also titled the African American Family Preservation Act. The purpose of this bill is to keep Black families in Minnesota intact when they come in contact with Child Protective Services. These families find themselves at the mercy of a court system they know little about and at a structural disadvantage because caseworkers may not be knowledgeable in cultural considerations when deciding on where an African-American child is best placed. This bill is meant to address those disparities that Black families face in the child protection system. These disparities show up in reporting, where African-American children are over 3 times more likely than their white counterparts to be reported to child protection. When this happens, caseworkers assess these homes and often institute removal proceedings when there are not egregious allegations of harm, but instead families need supportive services for better housing, education, employment, and/or healthcare. In those situations, African American children are removed from their home at least 3 times or even more higher than their white counterparts. We see that 60% of cases involving African American children are assigned to the family investigative path for discretionary reasons compared to 39% for white children. The family investigation path has proven to be more punitive, involves the courts, and places a maltreatment finding on African-American parents when it is often not warranted. In order to provide some protections when facing the court system, This bill seeks to add a right to counsel for emergency removal hearings, specify that a court cannot terminate an African-American parent's rights solely because of a failure to complete a case plan, and provide the ability for an oversight counsel to discuss specific cases when requested by a family or parent. The bill also provides a framework for DHS and Child Protection to engage with African-American families to ensure preservation of the family unit or maintaining children within their larger family structures. The bill is meant to protect the best interests of African-American children and promote the stability and security of African-American families by establishing minimum standards to prevent arbitrary and unnecessary removal of African-American children from their families. We all know that healthy families are vital to the success of our children and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring Minnesota's child protection system is fair and equitable. Your support of this bill will help decrease racial disparities and the injustices faced by these families. I have one testifier with me today who can discuss aspects of the bill that focus on the court system and data privacy. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Bornum Spears.
All right, Ms. Bornum, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Rhea Bornman Spears. I work with Khalees Houston and her Village Arms organization and have found myself in the midst of realizing how important it is that someone advocate the way that Khalees has been trying to advocate. And I would like to give an introduction of telling you that the reason I've chosen to testify about this is because professionals in the power roles in child protection cases, professionals who often look like me, not the African-American parent or child that they find themselves representing, need to be reminded by a strong message from the legislature that they need to double and triple check that the results of their work does not show bias. And of course, I'm talking about accidental or purposeful bias, but we'll assume for the purposes of a lot of this conversation that it's accidental bias. So I am prepared, obviously, to answer questions if that's a better way to handle a lot of this. I want to make sure, though, that you all are familiar with the statistics to know why this is so important. For example, the fact that across the state, Black children are 3 to 5 times more likely to have their parents' rights terminated. And that's across the state, but in Hennepin, our biggest county, they're 4.9 times more likely. And 55% of Hennepin's termination of parental rights cases are African American parents. And of course, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that African American children are also the highest population to move from child protection to juvenile detention. So this goes along with what Representative just testified about, telling you, you know, why this is important. So the pieces that I understand we're talking about today are Section 6, which has to do with the emergency removal hearing. And I don't know if you all are aware or not, but there are counties who are voluntarily providing counsel at that first hearing to all parents, but they're not required to. And we have seen over and over again how important it would be for them to be required to, because that hearing is crucial. So at that hearing, there's an opportunity to argue and clarify all kinds of things that could be the scenario in that situation that might get the kids back home, or might get the kids to a relative, or might get the kids somewhere else that would be much smaller of a shock to the system for the kids that have been removed. So there's obviously a lot I would want to say about how we wish that there wouldn't be any removals, but that's the reason I feel that that moment is so important in the case, because, you know, maybe you get the kids home. Maybe you get the kids to grandma, to an aunt. I don't know if I should go piece by piece to let you all have questions or do my general overview of all three sections, and I'll defer to you.
I think we're good. I know people's hands are starting to raise, so I think people do have questions and want to make sure we get to those. Again, I assume members have read the bill before we start committee, or at least they're reading fast in the moment. First, we have a question for, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bornman-Spears, and thank you for being available for questions. First on the list, we have Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje, for bringing this bill. I just have a quick question on lines 4.21 through, sorry, I don't have to squint my eyes to see how far down it goes. It looks like it's around 4.27. It talks about, unless the court has clear and convincing evidence that the child's health or welfare would be immediately endangered. And I've heard this bill, I heard it, or a similar version last session. I care about this issue, but I just wonder if you could talk about why you picked clear and convincing evidence. That seems strong. So unless they have clear and convincing evidence of an immediate endangerment, the child stays in the home while they go through this plan. And I just am concerned that that's not in the best interest of the child, because even if there's not clear and convincing evidence, or if it's not immediate, like right now, there still could be harm done to a child while the family's going through this plan. So I wondered if you could just address why you picked those two standards. Thank you.
Representative Agbaje, I'll give you first crack at it. Although I know we do have a couple people on the list to help with questions, so I'll let you go first, Representative, and then we'll see if you need a pinch hitter as well.
No problem. Actually, I think I will actually defer either to my testifier, Ms. Bornman-Spears, to answer that question.
Thank you,
Ms. Bornman-Spears. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So one thing that I would start off with saying is that there are a lot of policies and practices that we're all used to seeing the system do. And then there's research that has been done, and a lot of updates to that research has been done to find out what's actually best for the kids, which often contradicts what we may think is best for the kids. So to give a specific example, we have studies that have found that children who are being maltreated in a home still fare better in their long-term life results if they stay in that home rather than be removed. There's an organization called ALEA, and there's a woman there that I will quote. She said, removing a child should be the nuclear option. And the reason is because the studies have shown that it is so damaging to the child to be removed that you should not do it unless it's absolutely necessary. So clear and convincing, I still think that that's a low standard, right? Right now it's, we're talking about preponderance of the evidence, but clear and convincing raises the bar a little bit to, again, add that extra thought process for the decision maker to say, well, do we have to do this? Is there anything else I know about how we can make that home safe? For example, a safety plan. The statute requires that they write safety planning for each situation where they're considering removal. Can we bring another adult into the home that will supervise and help out? Is there another place everyone could go stay? There's all kinds of other options, and nuclear is the best word to describe removal for the damage that it has on the child. And I'm talking about future health problems, their sense of security lost. I have cases where children see police on the street and they cower. They don't like it when the doorbell rings. All kinds of traumatic effects that happen after those removals, because you have to remember that their parents and their home is the place that they're repeatedly told is safe. If they're taken away from that place by a stranger, no matter what may be going on at home, in that child's mind, they want to be home and they want to be with their parents. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Bornman-Spears. I see that Ms. Houston, who was one of the available for questions testifiers, also has a response. And I'll get back to you, Representative Robbins, once Ms. Houston has her chance to respond. So, Ms. Houston, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony, please.
Yes. Good evening, everybody. Khalees Houston, Executive Director of Village Arms, LLC. We advocate and support African-American families impacted by child protection, and I'm the primary advocate of the bill. The reason, I just wanted to provide some context there, because people outside of child protection naturally assume that if folks are involved with child protection, they must have done something that was just egregious, and they deserve to be a part of that system. But I want to share with folks that of the upwards of 15,000 children we had in care, only 9% were there for physical abuse and about 2% for sexual abuse. The vast majority of families involved with child protection in the state of Minnesota are involved for neglect. And per statute, that can mean anything, including inadequate food, clothing, or shelter. Those cases where egregious harm exists or there's an immediate risk or danger to the child are outlier cases. They are not what we typically see in the child protection realm. So there is time for social services to kind of slow down, speak to the parent about who their support network is, and to piggyback on what Rhea said, bring those folks in the implementation of a safety plan. So engaging the family's natural support networks to address whatever quote unquote crisis is occurring in the home. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Robbins, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to both of the testifiers. I just did have a question. If you could send me those studies, I'm really sort of a geek about stuff like that, and I would love to see it. And then the follow-up is, do those studies apply to all children? Because this bill is specifically tailored at only African-American children. So if it applies to all children, why wouldn't we make it more broadly available?
Ms. Borman-Spears or Ms. Houston, whoever wants to take that one.
You unmuted first. Go ahead, Rhea.
Oh, I just left it unmuted. I don't know if I should. Well, I would say that you make a good point that, yes, of course, we would want these things to apply to all children. But the fact of the matter is that we don't need to advocate for example, white children, because these things are already being thought of and there is already that hesitation before removing a child when they're white. And I would say that because of the statistics, because again, I'll remind you, you know, what I started off with, that it's 55% of Hennepin's TPRs are African-American parents. So the cases where the children never made it back home, 55% of the cases are African-American. So the studies, while they do not target race that I'm familiar with in the particular studies I'm referring to, one of which is a brief commissioned by that ALEA organization I mentioned, undoubtedly, they are most likely studying the majority of their studies, is what I'm trying to say, are probably African-American children, since those are the ones who are being removed at the higher rates.
Ms. Borman-Spears and Ms. Houston, if you could email some of those studies to Ms. Ghanani, the committee administrator, I think the whole committee could benefit from having access to those. So if you could share those, and we'll make sure that Representative Robbins and others get that information. We do have we have three other hands up, so I want to make sure we have time for folks. Next on the list is Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abadjay. I have some questions about the data provisions, particularly those, the very broad authority that this council is going to have that's being granted in this bill. And I'm just wondering, my first question is, how would you get your hands on police investigative data, since that is not, that information is not public until after the investigation is completed? Were you wanting to get your hands on it? You'd have to. If you're going to affect this case, you'd have to get your hands on that police investigative data before the investigation is finished, in order for you, the council, to be informed by it.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. So my understanding is that some of this police investigative data, some of it, especially when the police come to a family and take the first initial reports down, that's the type of information that you can get with a waiver from the family. At least that's my experience in other cases I've done. And I think for any data that would need to be completed after an entire investigation, I think that's something that the council would wait for in order to complete their review. So it's not that we would be getting data at the same time. It's not that the council will be getting data at the same time necessarily as the police, but whatever is readily available that pertains to that child's case is the type of data that, if a family requests the council to review that case, is what they would have access to. And Ms.
Representative
Ms. Borman-Spears, yeah, or Ms. Houston can add more. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, Representative Agbaje, my understanding is you've been working with Min Koji on a potential amendment for this section of the bill. Is that accurate? There's a lot of moving parts today.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is accurate. They did reach out last night at like 8 o'clock at night. So we are still in conversations about what those sections could look like to clarify. But as of right now, that's where we are.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Houston.
Yep, I was just going to add, so the council wouldn't necessarily be requesting data that's not already a part of that child protection case file. So the purpose of reviewing that data and the specific data that was outlined was in relation to their child protection case. And the family would have to give permission for the council. They would actually be coming to the council requesting that the council review their case for that purpose.
Okay, thank you. That is helpful. Representative Scott, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I just learned a whole bunch of information from what you intend the bill to be, but it's not in the language of the bill. And I understand you're working with Min Koji, and I would ask that you, myself or somebody else, because Min Koji is about government transparency. They're going to want to make sure that what the board does is more public, that the public eye can be seen so we know what this board is doing, what kind of work products they're producing, and that sort of thing. But on the other side of that is the privacy piece. And you're asking for a lot of data here. There needs to be consent to grab the data. We need to know how long the data is going to be kept by this board. There are a lot of questions regarding the data piece, and I have great concerns about this board and the qualifications of the people that are on it and exactly what kind of authority they're going to have to be making decisions. I see they're even going to be able to have access to personnel data of the social workers, and I don't know anywhere else in statute that a board like this, that's largely members of the public, would have access to that. What if they breach that data? What if it gets out there in the public realm? Is somebody going to be sued for breaching that data? I have a lot of concerns about this data section, and it really needs to be buttoned up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Scott.
Wait, Ms. Houston, you got to wait for me to recognize you.
My apologies, Chair.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Ms. Houston.
I was just going to add, under the case review section, we did outline at the parents or upon the parents' request. So again, the council wouldn't be asking to review anything that the parent did not request that we review because of some wrongful child removal or another discriminatory practice on the part of the child welfare staff. The purpose of reviewing the personnel data is because we have had instances, myself and Rhea, where we fought with the county attorney's office and others about social workers submitting fabricated evidence. We've had proof of that, and we had no grounds to hold anyone accountable because there's just nothing in place to protect these families from this type of thing occurring. So we would only be reviewing data again that the family requests. And we have the Citizens Review Panel in both Hennepin, Ramsey, and other counties that does very similar work where they actually do review child protection cases. And they have to complete confidentiality agreements and so forth. And this council would be held to that same standard.
All right. Thank you. Representative Novotny is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be directed at Ms. Spear. Did I hear you wrong? And hopefully you can clear this up for me. Did you imply that the Hennepin County Social Service and Foster Care System is racist without this program? That the only reason that, you cited some numbers saying that, without this program, it's a problem because there's kids in foster care that wouldn't be without this? Could you clear that up? I would hope that the Hennepin County foster care system, just like any foster care system, and if we want to modify it or make some changes, I understand. But are you implying that it's implicitly racist just because the numbers are different?
And first, I think this is a good opportunity to remind members that when a system has results that are disproportionately impacting different races of people differently, then that system is inherently racist. It's not, there doesn't even have to be intention behind it. That when we do see disparate outcomes, that is a racist, those are racist results. And so I wanna make sure that we're leveling the playing field as far as what we're talking about when we talk about something that's racist. And if members have this, a good reminder, if you haven't read the Select Committee report on racial justice, this is that's a good place to start. But I will Ms. Borman-Spears, if you want to respond.
I could rephrase, or
I think your question was clear. Ms. Borman-Spears.
Well, I can even make it simpler, Madam Chair.
I don't think I need it to be simplified, but I guess if you'd like
Ms.
to,
Ms. Borman-Spears, you can go ahead and Ms. Borman-Spears, you have the floor.
All right, thank you. My answer had to do with statistics and the experience that is well documented. What really shocked me when I first learned about these statistics is that this information is public. This isn't a secret. Hennepin County tracks their disparities, and they are actively working on programs to improve them. Ramsey County tracks their disparities, and they're actively working on programs to improve them. DHS tracks the disparities in the state and puts them out there on their public websites. All of this information is known, and it's been going on for years and years and years with very minimal improvement. And so I really appreciate, you know, what I believe I call you chairperson or chairwoman, you know, said to remind us all that, yes, I mean, we can call the system racist without attacking anyone, because it just, it's a matter of how things, you know, are happening. And why I started off my introduction by saying that some of that bias is purposeful, but a lot of it is accidental. So I can give you tons of examples of cases where the professionals may have chosen to support a certain caretaker because they felt more comfortable. They looked like them. They thought like them. They talked like them. And those kinds of small biases come up all over the place. And I could go on and on about, with examples, which, of course, you know, I haven't been given the opportunity or told that there's an abundant amount of time to do. But essentially, the numbers are what they are. And so we need to fix it. And this is, I believe, obviously, a way to fix it. That's why I'm here to support it.
And we've got a couple more hands up, and I do want to get to member questions, or many people will not have their bills heard later this week. So I'm going to move on to Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate it. You know, Representative Novotny's question, because I think it highlights something that we all need to be aware of. In the state of Minnesota, we have these huge disparities. I mean, disproportionately impacting our BIPOC communities, and particularly our young Black kids taken away from their families. This bill, Representative Maje, thank you for ringing this bill, and thank you for the testifiers that are here today to support it and provide more details. This bill is absolutely something that will disrupt the system. It's meant to try to cure some of these disparities that we have. And so I think anytime we see bills like this, we need to take a really close look and just get to the root cause of why we need these bills, because we do need these bills. They are absolutely designed to disrupt something, the systems that have been happening for a long time. I mean, the systems are so, they're in place now, and they're running like well-oiled machines, and they are getting the outcomes that they were designed to get. And individuals that are working in them may not necessarily be racist, but the systems put in place were designed to do what they're doing, and they're continuing to do that. And without bills that disrupt that, without policies and actions that disrupt that, they will continue. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. We're going to go to Representative Johnson. It'll be the last discussion that we'll take, and then we'll go to the vote. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative. I've been looking at this. I don't know about anybody else, but I have a habit of following bills that I know are going to show up in committees I'm in. This is a very lengthy bill with a lot of issues in it that should have been taken care of in the Health and Human Services Committee before it came to this committee. because what they do there can change dramatically what's going to be happening with some of the stuff in this bill. Unfortunately, it came here first. So this bill's never had a real proper vetting yet. And I know there's going to be a lot of changes. So that's concerning. One of the testifiers brought up the first initial report, which is called in law enforcement terms, it's the ICR initial complaint report. That's basic information, no investigation, a minor report. Anything, there's a report that goes investigative, that is not released until after the investigation is over and after the county attorney or even child protection is done with the case before any of that is released. And a lot of it's classified as private because it involves a child, unless there's a criminal charges. So that police investigation data could be tied up for years before it could even be released. One of the things I'm concerned about in this bill is it removes protections for that child that were put in place a couple of years ago. We had an incident where down in, I believe it was in Representative Scott's district, a child was killed, and that child actually lived in my district. It was because child protection didn't do their job and actually removed that child. And one of the parents was able to have custody, and that child was killed in their care by that person. So I have a lot of problems with this because I want to make sure that child is safe. Now, this is also totally different than the child protection issues we dealt with. It might have been a year or two ago and I fully supported it, dealing with the indigenous children, making sure that they followed those guidelines with the federal government. This is way beyond that, and I wish if it was following those same guidelines, I wouldn't have a problem with this. But those protections for those children are not here. And so I have a big concern with this bill. And I'm going to ask the author to go look at the requirements in the indigenous bill that we dealt with a few years ago, clarifying with federal and state law to make sure that those children are properly placed when appropriate. And making sure that
Representative Johnson, this is the bill before us. We, if you could wrap up your comments, I'd really appreciate it.
I will be. But like I say, I have concerns that this could actually be more harmful than helpful at this time. And if there's any changes, Chair Becker-Finn, if there's any changes in the data status, I'm going to ask that you do bring it back here so we can actually vet what's actually in the bill and what data is actually going to be used, because I'm sure this is going to change and we're going to need to look at it again. Thank you.
We do amend a lot of bills here in the legislature. With that, Representative Agbaje, any closing comments before we get to the vote?
I see that Ms. Houston has her hand up.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for any additional testimony. I think everything's out there, and I think we've had a good discussion. Any closing words?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the time today. I appreciate it. This is a bill that is meant to address and repair systemic harm that has been done to Black families and Black children. And so when that happens, it is upon us as legislators to see how we can repair that harm and make sure that we are minimizing that damage. This is a step towards that. We have heard from many people today that have concerns, and we will take those concerns into consideration as we move forward with this bill. So I look forward to your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1151, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling? Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Oh.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There are 10 ayes and 6 nays.
Right. With that, the motion prevails and House File 1151, as amended, is on its way to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Egbadje, and thank you to the testifiers for bringing this forward. Next on the list is Vice Chair Mohler's bill, House File 1653. Vice Chair Mohler, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1653 be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee.
All right, thank you. Your bill is now before us, but I understand you have an author's amendment. Could you tell us about your author's amendment and move the amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. I do have an oral amendment to the A1 amendment, and so I'm not quite sure if you would like me to handle the oral amendment first.
So I think you have to move the A1 to get it in front of us, and then you can do the oral amendment to the A1.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I'll move the A1 author's amendment. And this amendment just is, it really is technical, some technical language fixes.
Okay. Please go ahead. And I understand that you did communicate with House Research. But if you could get this on the record as clearly as possible, we would all appreciate it. So go ahead, Vice Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the oral amendment members would be at line 1.4. After the word board, we would insert or tribal nation. So again, I'll just say that one more time on line 1.4. After the word board, we would also insert or tribal nation.
All right, is that it?
That's it.
Okay, sounds good. So I think then any discussion to what we're trying to do here? All right, and then House Research, if you could just give me a thumbs up or weigh in just real quickly to make sure that you have what you need so that we've got this correct.
Madam Chair and members, yes, the oral amendment to the A1 amendment, page 1, line 4, after board, insert, or tribal nation.
Okay. So now the all those, let's see, so do we, let's... All those in favor of the oral amendment to the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails on your oral amendment. And now to the underlying A1 amendment as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. Your amendment, the A1 amendment, is adopted. Vice Chair Mohler, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. So, members, this bill is part of a larger Department of Human Services bill, and the provisions before you today are focused on items that are relevant to our committee. The bill essentially does two things. First, it streamlines children's mental health screening reporting by providing access to DHS with information that's needed to track the effectiveness of DHS grants to counties and tribes who conduct these screenings. In your packets, you'll find a letter of support from the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators about this particular provision and why it's needed. Second, the bill updates the public guardianship statute in a way that reflects the modernization of the other guardianship statutes that we did last year. That's all I have, Madam Chair. I do have one testifier, Christy Grom.
Okay, Ms. Grom, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Community Supports Administration at the Department of Human Services. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present this bill today, and thank you, Vice Chair Mahler, for authoring it. I'll do a very brief overview of the bill to provide some context to members, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
If you could give us a real brief summary, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Like Representative Mahler said, this is the aim of this bill is really two parts. The first part modifies the way data is collected for children's mental health screening grants. These are grants that were established in 2003 to ensure early identification of mental health conditions for children who are involved in child welfare and juvenile justice systems. So the grants are administered to nearly all of our Minnesota counties, as well as three tribal nations. And they're really there to ensure that children get the right services at the right time in their development. So this proposal modifies current law just to allow the county board to provide the commissioner with individualized data for the purposes of improved program evaluation. So under current law, we have access to a minimal amount of basic summary data for these grants, but not enough to understand how the grants are impacting children and where there might be some gaps in outcomes and why. The last thing I'll say about this particular provision is that it's just important to note that it modifies the way the data is collected, but it doesn't modify how the data is classified. So individual screening results will remain private as currently is required by statute. And then the second part of this bill, like Representative Mahler mentioned, modernizes our public guardianship area of law. So members, public guardianship is a separate area of law from private guardianship. It's a last resort option where the Commissioner of Human Services is petitioned to provide guardianship for a person who has a developmental disability and who may have a questionable capacity to meet health and safety needs on their own. The proposal primarily consists of terminology updates that align with our person-centered practices and person-first language. For example, we're changing the term ward to person subject to guardianship throughout the bill. But in addition to the terminology changes, there are just three more substantive changes that I will briefly touch on before we can move on to member questions. So the first change is related to public conservatorship. So public conservatorship is no longer used largely because it would create a potential conflict of interest to have the same entity providing guardianship as the duties that go along with conservatorship. So as you'll see throughout the bill, there are several instances where public conservatorship is removed. Private conservatorship remains an option for people and is considered one of the less restrictive alternatives to public guardianship. So less restrictive alternatives is the second area I wanted to touch on briefly. So this bill, like the 2020 private guardianship updates, requires that less restrictive interventions must be used prior to pursuing public guardianship to ensure that there's no other way to provide the care and safety of the person. So examples of less restrictive alternatives could be the use of a healthcare directive, having trusted family and friends help pay bills and deposit checks, power of attorneys, or developing a supportive decision-making plan. Which brings me to the third concept that I'll touch on briefly, supportive decision-making. So you'll see this concept pepper throughout the bill as well. This is really an alternative to the traditional guardianship process. It's a person-centered approach that acknowledges that all people, including elders, people with disabilities, you and I, occasionally need some help to make our decisions. So even though someone may not be able to make all of their decisions independently, they may still be able to participate in decision-making. So rather than using our court process to sort of take away most of their legal rights, we would empower the person with supportive decision-making to have them be a part of that process. And we know that people who feel that they have positive control over their lives are less likely to experience abuse and exploitation. So maintaining this option for the person to be engaged could also serve to keep them safer and happier than maybe a traditional guardianship could. So that's all I have for my testimony, Madam Chair. I'm happy to stand for questions.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question, I believe, would go to Ms. Grame. I don't know if I pronounced that right or not. I'm wondering, when you get these screening results for the kids, what information in those screening results is of value to you folks?
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, so we're looking for more individualized data that helps us determine, for example, if in County A, we find that 30% of qualified three-year-olds are receiving the required service after they get the assessment. And then in addition, only, you know, of those eligible three-year-olds, 80% of their parents are refusing the services. So trying to understand from that information, why is there a gap? What can we do to improve the services? Is there a specific demographic where we're seeing gaps in services where we're not following up with children and families to make sure they get the appropriate services following those assessments?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I asked that is I didn't know if you needed every single data set that was part of that screening result, which, and then my other question is, or two questions are, do you obtain consent from the parent to have that data shared so that it's okay with them? They get to sign off saying, yes, we'll give this information to you and here's how it's going to be used. And then also, how long do you need to retain the data?
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe there are certain situations where a parent may provide consent. I'll have to get back to you on that particular piece. And I actually think it might be in front in the statute before us, so I can pull up that language for you. But in terms of how long we retain this information, it depends on whether or not there was a maltreatment determination. So if there was a maltreatment determination, then we maintain the information for 10 years. And if there was not a determination, then we would keep it for 5 years.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yep. Yeah, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what the 5 year and the 10 year, is that already in current statute or is that just your policy?
Ms. Grom. And then I want to make sure of time for Representative Robbins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, you know, I'm not sure if that's in statute. I would have to check. Some of this has to do with our child safety and permanency area of the department, so we can check with them and get back to you about where exactly that requirement lives to make sure that you're aware.
Thank you.
Yep, and Ms. Grom, if you could share that with the committee administrator, I think that would be helpful for everybody to know. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to ask Representative Mueller about the A1 amendment. It says the data is now classified as private on individuals, but it still says the board and the may provide the commissioner and the tribal governments with access to these screening results. So it doesn't really specify that they wouldn't be accessing that individual data. So is there any way to work on that so it's, you know, specified that it's de-identified or somehow grouped together? Or is that not your intent? Because the testifier just said again that they really want the individualized data. So I'm trying to understand how the amendment works. Thank you.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And they do, Representative Robbins, want the individualized data. I don't know if Ms. Grom wants to answer that further.
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think we do want the individualized data when counties and tribes put that into the SSIS system. But when we pull it out, we do pull it out in a bit more of an aggregate form. So there are some protections in place in the process that we have to access that data. And I'd be happy to work with you offline if you have more questions or have ideas on how to make this language stronger. We did work with Minkoji on this particular piece of the amendment.
Representative Robbins, any follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, thank you. But I would like to see how this plays out because I think there's some sort of inherent inconsistency in how it's currently written. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just ask for your support and happy to continue working on improved language as we continue to work on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chair Mueller renews her motion that House File 1653, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Okay. We have 15 ayes and one nay.
All right, with that, the motion prevails and House File 1653 as amended is on to the Human Services Committee. What is, I'm assuming, going to be the last bill we get to today, House File 1442. It is Representative Zhang's bill. We'll remind members that we're going to focus on Article 1 relating to data and then Article 5 relating to state appellate review. Representative Zhang, would you like to move your bill to the Public Safety Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 1442 to the Public Safety Committee.
All right, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This proposal, House File 1442, updates the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, Minnesota Statutes 192A, and related statutes to better reflect recent changes to corresponding federal law and to remediate potential weaknesses in our existing court-martial process. It has five main purposes. First, it modifies the statute that authorizes the release of law enforcement information to be used for disciplinary action under the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. Modifies statutes section 1391 and section 1393 to clarify that certain data regarding members of the National Guard is inherently federal data and therefore subject to the Freedom of Information Act rather than the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And then secondly, it modifies section 192A.15 and section 192A.155 and adds language to section 192A that allows, under certain conditions, military attorneys who are not members of the Minnesota Bar to perform limited legal duties under the supervision of the Minnesota National Guard staff judge advocate. Thirdly, it clarifies certain jurisdictional details regarding when service members are subject to discipline under the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, and clarifies that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the proper investigative authority for military-specific crimes. Updates the Minnesota Code of Military Justice to align with recent changes to the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice and to allow procedural commonality with the federal code. Fourth, it modifies various clauses in Section 192A to clarify the process for appeals of court-martial verdicts and to better align verbiage with Section 192A with broader Minnesota law, statute of limitations, and penalties. And finally, it updates the punitive articles, which is various sections of Minnesota Statutes 192A, to mirror recent changes to the federal code, including acts by persons in positions of special trust and non-consensual distribution of intimate images, among others. And then I have Executive Director Don Kerr and Lieutenant Colonel Blumgren here too to testify.
All right, Commissioner Kerr, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. And very briefly, I just did want to state this is an agency bill. We've been working on this for a couple of years, and we've worked it very closely with the Attorney General's office and the judiciary. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Colonel Blomgren then to describe the bill in detail.
All right. Thank you, Executive Director Kerr. Officer Blomgren, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I am Lieutenant Colonel David Blomgren, and serve as General Counsel for the Minnesota National Guard and the Department of Military Affairs, where I act as a full-time legal advisor to the Adjutant General and other senior leaders in the organization. I assumed this role in 2018 after spending 11 years on active duty in the Air Force. First, let me thank you for inviting me to testify this afternoon in support of this bill. Compared to the active duty force, Our military justice structure is quite different given the fact that most of our members are not on a duty status most days of the month. While we currently have the legal ability on paper to conduct a court-martial, there are gaps that would make it legally impractical to conduct one now. This bill will fill those gaps and in turn will provide that additional legal tool in the commander's toolbox to ensure good order and discipline in the Minnesota National Guard. One of the gaps this bill fills is the legal authority to receive law enforcement data on Minnesota National Guard members when they are investigated by local law enforcement. In many cases, when local law enforcement investigates a crime and their prosecutor determines there's not enough evidence to pursue criminal charges, we still have the ability to pursue administrative action or pursue a court-martial. 9 times out of 10, local jurisdictions provide us the relevant investigation so that we can take action. However, some jurisdictions currently do not. And this simply adds to the time it takes to investigate wrongdoings, since we then must do our own investigation, particularly when it comes to sexual assault cases. This bill would authorize the Adjutant General to receive, via request from my office, law enforcement data of members in our organization for the sole purpose of taking administrative or criminal action. Along a similar vein, this bill would clarify other data protections as it relates to members of the Minnesota National Guard. Given our current our unique dual state and federal missions and authorities, the release of data depends on the status of a member. For the most part, unless a member is activated for a state active duty mission, for example, a COVID-19 response or civil unrest mission, data is released under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And this bill would clarify that the federal National Guard records are therefore not subject to the Data Practices Act, but are processed under FOIA. However, it would also add a protection to Guard members that are activated for a state mission and therefore subject to the Data Practices Act, since they are considered state employees for such missions. Currently, an adversary could request a list of all National Guard members that were on a state active duty mission, and Chapter 13 is unclear on whether or not such a list of names will be considered public or private data. This bill would classify it as private data, thereby making it consistent with the Department of Defense's policy in not releasing names of military members for force protection measures. This bill also clarifies or fills a number of jurisdictional gaps and ambiguities that currently exist on paper. Specifically, it clarifies when members are subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, clarifies which crimes are considered military-specific crimes and therefore give us primary jurisdiction, and clarifies the maximum punishment for the punitive articles of the code. It also specifies that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the investigative arm for the Minnesota National Guard for military-specific crimes. Fourth, the bill fills the appellate process for a court-martial. Currently, it's unclear how a defendant or the government would appeal a court-martial proceeding, and the changes clarify when the appeal period starts to run and clarifies the appropriate authority is the Minnesota Supreme Court. These changes have been reviewed and concurred by the Minnesota Attorney General's Appellate Division. Finally, this bill aligns the Minnesota Code of Military Justice with the updates to the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice with respect to newly added punitive articles. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel. I'm sorry I called you officer before. Thank you for testifying. Members, any questions? I know this is a lot of background work that the department's been working on for a while, so I appreciate Representative Zhang bringing this forward. Not seeing any member questions. Representative Zhang, any final words on the bill?
Oh, thank you. I know Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren and Don Kerr had been working really hard on this, and looking forward to going to public safety and presenting our bill.
All right, thank you. With that, I will, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House Bill 1442 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy, Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Pass for right now.
Okay. Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Fain?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Okay. There's 15 ayes and no nays.
Novotny's aye.
All right, Novotny's aye. So I think that puts us at what, 16 ayes?
16 ayes, no nays.
Thank you, Anna. Just want to make sure we got that right. With that, the motion prevails and House File 1442 is on its way to public safety. We have 6 minutes, so we're at least going to get started and make good use of these last 6 minutes we have of committee. House File 1218 is next on the agenda. This is another Representative Zhang bill. Representative Zhang, would you like to move that House File 1218 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
I move House File 1218, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. We have your bill before us. We do have one testifier. If you don't mind, I'm going to go straight to your testifier so we can get that in while he is here. Kevin Kyer from the Board of Public Defense, keeping in mind that I've got 5 minutes before I got to wrap us up. Mr. Kyer, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, this is William Ward, the State Public Defender. Mr. Kyer could not be here, so he asked if I could sit in this evening on the hearing.
That's absolutely fine. Please go ahead, Mr. Ward.
For the record, William Ward, I'm a State Public Defender. Very briefly, interpreters are a necessary service for us to represent our clients. For the non-English speaking individuals who are not fluent in English speaking. For over 2.5 decades, when our funding ran out for what we would call expert services under Statute 611.21, we would then petition the county for funding. We would go through the chief judge and ask for the funding for interpreters. In 2019, in the Cruz Montanez case, the appellate court stated that that funding requirement was needed to be borne by the Board of Public Defense. We petitioned the Supreme Court for review, but unfortunately at that point, Mr. Cruz Montanez had fled out on his case, so the issue became moot. The use of 611.21 funding has been ongoing since Akey versus Oklahoma. When expert witnesses run out, whether it be for forensic issues, for transcripts, or for interpreters, if our funding runs out, it's just a simple process of petitioning the court for that funding. We've asked that this 611.21 to be amended to include interpreters as part of that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ward. I know that a fiscal note was requested and it came back with no cost, which is why this is going to the general register. Representative Johnson, try to be brief.
Chair Becker-Finn, I will be brief. I have a lot of concerns with the fiscal note. I was looking at it. It did not include any local impact. So I have a bad feeling that if this goes on, it will be up to the counties that are going to have to pay for this. I've worked with the interpreters in the past in my career in law enforcement, and they are not cheap. They're very expensive. You have more than one person involved. Each individual has their own interpreter. So the costs are quite high. I would suggest holding on to this a little bit so we can get a local impact fiscal note as well, because like I say, I'm really concerned about the cost and passing it on to our local counties.
Madam Chair, if I can respond.
Mr. Ward, we don't really have a lot of time, but if you could, 30 seconds, Mr. Ward.
In 30 seconds, the use of interpreters in court is not a part of this. The courts automatically pay for that. That's part of the system now. There is no local impact because we're either going to be encumbering the money for interpreters and we run out of money for expert witnesses. We're going to be going to the counties no matter what. So that's the reason why there's no fiscal impact.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Ward. That was important to get on the record. Any closing words, Representative Zhang? Oh, you're muted.
No words. Mr. Ward,
all right.
Summarize it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Representative Zhang. And I will note, you know, interpreters, it is a very specialized service that is, it can be difficult to provide in the courtroom. And we certainly appreciate making sure everyone, no matter what language they speak, has access to the public defenders. So with that, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 1218 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Representative Mullen?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There's 16 ayes and no nays.
With that, the motion prevails, and House Bill 1218 is recommended to be placed on the general register. My clock just turned over to 6:30. Good job, everybody, on a busy and productive evening. We will see you in the morning. With that, we are adjourned.